panel member has been given a bound set of documents called Appellant's Notice of Exhibits for Oral Argument. Does counsel for Appley have any objection to our considering these documents? And then it would appear to be part of the record, but I couldn't take that with certainty.
Your Honor, the documents are, I believe, a part of the record. They are, however, at least my copy is highlighted by counsel. So, of course, they don't appear in the record highlighted.
Okay, well, we will note that, and to the extent that this is presented to us as documents in the record, with which statement of which you agree, we'll assume the highlighting is for advocacy purposes and is not the way the documents exist in their original form. Is that acceptable?
Yes.
All right. If there's been any turnover in our spectators, if you do have any cell phones or similar devices, please turn them off. Otherwise, we're ready for argument in Andorado versus Denver Transit.
Good afternoon. On behalf of Andorado Construction Corporation, my name is Thomas Michael Sullivan, Jr. Bar number 9566. We're appealing from adverse ruling on motion for summary judgment, and it's a contract interpretation issue. We provided these exhibits from the appeal record, and we've highlighted them to expedite and simplify our presentation. I'd like to state Andorado's position as clearly as possible. So if you please turn to tab 1, this is the order from which we're appealing. If you turn to page 6, what we're appealing from is highlighted in yellow and pink. In yellow, Judge Martinez seemed to feel that our position was absurd. And he also seemed to feel that if he did not give meaning and effect to the subordinate order of precedence clause, otherwise he would have no purpose. So the incorrect premise in yellow results in an incorrect conclusion in pink. And that conclusion is that there was no unconditional promise. So I'd like to turn back to page 2 and tab 1. The language that Andorado is relying upon is highlighted in blue and pink. In blue it says structures will be released by task orders as parcels become available. I call that the will order language. It's in blue. In pink it says pricing for the structures requiring demolition will be based on unit pricing set forth in part 2. Part 2 is tab 3. The prices are 10-3. And I call this we'll use our prices language. The language that Denver Transit is relying upon is highlighted in yellow in the second paragraph. The plaintiff will submit a proposal as to that language. To frame the dispute, I've also highlighted in yellow the first line of the defendant's clause, except as expressly provided elsewhere in this contract. And I would submit to you that this subordinate order precedence clause in yellow forgot the pink language on this page. That's long and short of our case. If you turn to tab 2, please, and go to the second page, you will see again, highlighted in blue and pink, the same language that was in the fourth order. But also, at the top of the page in Article 2, it says, there's an order precedence clause. It says the highest order precedence in the contract is the signature document. If you look in the upper right-hand corner, this is the contract signature document. So it's our position that this blue and pink language has the highest order precedence. Please turn the page. In the reply brief, the answer brief, there was some discussion of the not guaranteed clause, which is highlighted here in yellow. We would submit that the defendant's argument that all of the buildings were not guaranteed because of this language is incorrect. And there's three good reasons why it's incorrect. First, there could be a mistake in the contract, so please turn to tab 3. And in tab 3, you're going to see, highlighted in yellow, two buildings, or two lines that are highlighted in yellow. They're the same. There was a mistake in the contract. That's one reason why $3.3 million might not be guaranteed.
Wouldn't that be true in any contract? I mean, if there, you don't really need a clause to say if there's a mistake, other terms may change.
Sure. Let me give you a second reason.
Please.
I agree. That's true in any contract. Okay. Second reason, if you go to the second page of tab 3, there's something highlighted in pink. The rule language says, as buildings become available for demolition, suppose RTD decided not to demolish a building but instead to remodel it. That happened. It's the pink highlighting.
Is that in the record?
No. There's a third reason. Suppose that the predecessor contractors, and there were asbestos abatement contractors, had to demolish a complete wall or something like that. That's a change leading the scope of work for Mandarata's demolishing a building. Obviously, Denver Transit wouldn't want a credit. That would be handled under normal changes clause. So let's go to tab 4. At tab 4, on the first page, this is the clause that Denver Transit is relying upon. Judge Martinez got all focused on the yellow in the second paragraph. He said nothing about the acceptance expressed and provided elsewhere in the contract. We've already discussed that. The pink language in tab 2 falls within the expressly provided elsewhere in the contract. So Judge Martinez said, I don't understand the purpose of this clause. It is a rule of contract interpretation that you try and harmonize all of the clauses in the contract. And we would suggest that this clause is here for the instance where Denver Transit wanted to add a building to the existing suite of 44 buildings. Please turn the page. In paragraph 2, there's a sentence highlighted in yellow, and the first word, when, is highlighted in pink. And the when is important. It imposes a condition precedent. When a requirement is established, requesting a complete and detailed price proposal. If you have 44 prerequisite price buildings, and you're going to use those prices, you have to step back and say, well, when does this kick in? And that's when you add another building. The only time to add the request a price proposal is if you don't have a price. And what would that be for? And before a building, you're going to add. So you add a price. You ask for a price proposal. Denver Transit should do what? They should identify a building, ask for a price proposal, get it from Andorado, and then they reserve the right to evaluate it. And if they don't like it, they can negotiate it. And if they don't like the result of the negotiation, you're going to say, fine, we're not hiring you for that building. That's the purpose of the prior page clause, and the language highlighted in yellow, and that's covered here. If we turn to tab 5, this is the normal changes clause in the contract. It's just a clause in our contract. The first paragraph on page 5 says the scope of work shall be subject to change by additions, deletions, or revisions. Remember my third reason why something might not be guaranteed is deletion. It's right here in black and white. Second paragraph says if Andorado thinks there's a change, provide notice. This is a second changes clause. If you turn the page to tab 6, there's another changes clause. There's a third changes clause in the contract, pricing for changes. Company may request and contractors should provide proposals for scope of work changes. That's covered in the other clause. Additions and deletions, covered in the other clause, which are priced at the company's option by one or a combination of the following methods. And the first method is by issuing a task order request, ask for proposal. It's consistent. I want to talk about scope of work changes. We provided a case called General Contract and Constructions, 1937, that the Court of Claims basically saying the following. You can't delete an entire building under a scope of changes, change order clause. That is a breach of contract. That's been law of the land for 75 years.
Let me ask you a question, counsel.
Yes, sir.
And I want you to go outside of the record, so if your answer requires that, let me know. You said something about a predecessor asbestos abatement removal company.
Yes.
Was there one in place during the time period when the four buildings in question were handed off to them rather than to your company?
It is outside the record, and the answer is yes.
Does the record include any of the TORs that were issued?
Yes, and they are in the appeal record.
Do those TORs simply pick up the pricing on the schedule?
Yes, I did have that comment. What happened was, when they issued task order one and task order two, which are both part of the appeal record, they just used the prices. They never requested a proposal. And further, outside the record, the only time they ever asked for a proposal was when they added a building. They asked us for a proposal, we gave them a proposal, they evaluated, they added a building. That was a change order, which is outside the record.
Is there any evidence in the record of the party's intent other than to the extent that that's argued from, by comparing different clauses in the contract? I mean, any evidence of industry practice?
Yes, I'm going to jump forward to tab eight. I have an argument here, and I'm going to skip to this particular tab. People who are involved in construction contracts, particularly for government projects, like the RTD project, would say, why isn't this resolved by termination for convenience clause? They know that there's a normal termination for convenience clause that says we can terminate you without cause. If you look here, it says, in the first line, you know, company may with cause terminate. So there's three inferences from that language. The first inference is, it was negotiated. Changed from without cause to with cause. The second is, if it was negotiated, then Ambarado would not agree that Denver Transit had the right to not give them any for 44 buildings. And the third inference is that Denver Transit never discussed its intent to give any of the 44 buildings in tab three to some other contractor with Ambarado prior to Ambarado signing a contract. An order of precedence clause argument.
Let me come back to my question for
yes,
just a minute. On page two of tab one, you put in blue, structures will be released by task orders as the parcels become available.
That's correct.
Is there any evidence in the record, other than by comparing the different terms in the contract, of what the parties meant by, quote, as the parcels become available, unquote?
I think that that's plain language.
Well, I'm on my question. My question is there any evidence in the record from negotiators, from people who claim to know industry practice?
And not in the appeal record. It was decided on summary judgment.
Well, you could have put in affidavits, I suppose.
We didn't.
Okay. Did either side argue in the summary judgment proceedings that this contract was ambiguous?
No. I'm going to come back to your first question. I think if you look at page 255 in the appeal record, there's an email dated September 28th from Denver Transit to Ambarado, explaining why they had changed the contract, partially explaining. That's the only other thing that's in the appeal.
Thank you.
The order of precedence argument. My prior discussion is that the tab two highlighted blue and pink language can be harmonized with the tab four yellow highlighted language with an alternative explanation. Now, Judge Martinez didn't see that. So you've got to look at what he did with regard to an order of precedence. The normal rule of law is that an order of precedence clause says if you have higher order of precedence, the conflicts with the lower order of precedence clause, you follow the higher one and throw the lower one away. That's the Franchi case that I gave you that was endorsed by the Court of Appeals of the Federal Circuit in 1989 and has effects. That's been the law for 40 years. That's simple. Judge Martinez didn't do that. So we would like you to do the following. Send this back to Judge Martinez and find that he committed the following errors. First, ignored the pink, we'll use our prices language in tab two, which was in his decision and was never further discussed. Second, he ignored the except is expressly provided elsewhere in the contract language in tab four. Again, which was in his opinion and was never further discussed. Third, he ignored the when language in tab four in article two. Okay. He never even saw that. There's no commentary, whatever. And finally, if he's got an order of precedence argument, he didn't follow order of precedence. We consider each of these four errors reversible errors. Ultimately, this is a contract interpretation issue. We come back to a central thing. Four buildings became available for demolition. They should have been ordered from Ambarado at the stated prices. They weren't. That's in the answer. okay? And that's an anticipatory breach of contract. We want you to send this back to Judge Martinez, finding that as a matter of law, not as a matter of fact, the contract was breached. Thank you. I have a minute and 15 seconds reserved. Thank you.
You're on the voting, Don, if you wish. You switch over and you're right there.
Okay, I'm good. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tiffany Stasiak. I'm here on behalf of the Appalee Denver Transit Constructors LLC, bar number 21535. We submit that the decision below should be affirmed for three reasons. When reading the plain language of the demolition contract, reading the provisions in harmony, and giving effect to all of the language, it's clear that DTC did not make an unconditional promise to issue task order releases to Andorado.
Okay, let me just stop you there. The day after the contract was signed, could DTC have told Andorado, we've got somebody else that we'd rather do business with on all 484 buildings, and therefore you're not going to see any TORs?
They wouldn't have had to have done that, Your Honor, under this contract. This contract would determine the path forward for the parties if DTC decided to issue a task order release to Andorado. DTC, there's no contract in existence requiring DTC to issue a task order release. There would be no requirement for DTC.
Okay, so your position is that this suite of documents didn't impose on DTC an obligation to do anything.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I liken it to, given that I'm a law firm, I'll use this hypothetical. It's much like the agreement that law firms will have with recruiters. During 2014, we may order to be filled the following positions. If we do that through you, we will agree to pay the following amounts. There's no requirement that that be done, but if it is done, the parties have an agreement on the path forward with that recruiter. Same thing in this instance. Yes,
but in this case, there were 44 buildings, and I understand you to say we didn't have to give any TORs to have any of them knocked down. But if you wanted them knocked down, then how did you have to proceed?
If we wanted the buildings to be demolished on the project, Your Honor, first, as by the plain language of the contract, we would determine if the parcel was available, as you suggested, and if demolition by Andorado was appropriate versus others. I will break for a second. I think it was you, Your Honor, who asked if there was anything in the record about the existence of an asbestos abatement contractor during that time. Yes, indeed, in the record at pages 26 and 27, an affidavit from Michael Lipinski talking about that very topic, that the asbestos abatement contractors were present at the project, and from time to time there would be decisions made on who was appropriate to handle a demolition. And so right, so in that, under that process, they would determine if it was available, whether Andorado was appropriate or not, and then they would use the process outlined in the project, in the contract. And the reason that the pricing comes to issue here, I'm just going to go with the exhibits since they're there. If you look at tab 3, which is the pricing schedule, which is part of the contract, what it says up at the top is unit price preambles and methods of measurement. Lump sum pricing for each item is based on demolition of the entire structure. If the entire structure is not demolished, the lump sum pricing for that item will be adjusted. And of course, when a TOR, task order release, is issued, then if it involves a scope of work, it may not contemplate that scope of work that is contemplated in the pricing for the entire demolition. If it doesn't, then the proposal would be for Andorado to come back and say, well, here's the new pricing if you're not going to do the full demolition.
Let me turn that around on you a little bit, though. If the TOR issues and it's 100% demolition, is Andorado stuck with these prices?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I mean, is it a unilateral contract in the sense of Andorado says, according to your interpretation, will knock the buildings down as you demand, and we're stuck with these prices, but we don't have a right to insist that you use this for anything?
Well, Your Honor, they don't have a right to insist that DTC use them. They're stuck with the prices, but DTC is stuck with the prices too. These parties have agreed that to what the prices will be for the entire demolition. And in fact, the record shows, and Andorado concedes, that when the two task orders were issued, they were issued for entire demolition with the pricing that you see as reflected in Schedule B. They used the same pricing, which also begs the question, if the purpose of the TOR is just to address changes to the contract, why were TORs issued in the first place? There were two task order releases issued for the project. They encompassed certain groupings of buildings, and they were for the entire demolition. There were no changes made to the scope. And I think it's important to talk about that the issuance of a TOR is not just a pricing concern, it's also a scope. And the contract reads that in plain words. It's a scope issue. It's a bonding issue. It's on an as-needed basis.
Well, could the TOR then be a mechanism for scheduling the demolition if they're not certain what the demolition schedule would be progressing into the future?
Your Honor, the scheduling provision is actually contemplated in the ordering provision under the TOR, that it would be Andorado who would come back and respond to DTC regarding the scheduling of the demolition and how they would proceed with that timing-wise.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, wouldn't it be a way for the DTC to have better control over the scheduling and not just leave it to Andorado?
Sure, and better control over who they choose to do the demolition, and better control over who the contractor is, whether the scope is appropriate for one contractor or another. And in this case, harkening back to the discussion earlier, there is, Your Honor, in the record, there are indications of the intent of the parties. Now, I realize that this is dangerous territory, given that nobody argued that the contract was ambiguous, but in order for Judge Martinez to use the common industry terms and interpretation of the task order release-based contract, he had that April contract that the parties initially entered into that was a guaranteed contract. The two contracts, the April and September contracts, are radically different. And that task order release language, that on an as-needed basis, you're going to have to show us that you can do the scope, that you can do the bonding. It's completely different in that second contract. And through Andorado's arguments now, what they're trying to do is gain the advantages of that first contract that we aren't arguing over here. So, yes, Your Honor.
Well, finish your thought, and then I have a question.
Oh, I'm finished.
Okay. What's nagging at me a little bit, Counselor, is this feels like a two-party contract, but yet I hear you say things like a DTC was to decide if Andorado was the appropriate one to do the work, they have better control, that you have better control over who was to do the demolition. What am I missing? Why isn't, at least on the record before us, this a two-party contract between you and them? And you've got this control to decide other work. What's in the record that sort of supports that you're right to give it to a third party as opposed to a two-party arrangement?
That the contract itself only contemplates the terms between the parties if they're going to do business together on these buildings, period. If they decide that they're going to do business together on these buildings, they're going to have to follow the terms of the contract, including the retainage, the safety, the termination, all of the terms of the contract. DTC is going to have to pay those prices. Otherwise, it's an illusory contract, and there can be no anticipatory repudiation of it either. But I don't hear that argument coming from Andorado. But the purpose of this contract at the onset was because Andorado did not have the ability to guarantee its work through bonding. It was Anderado who needed to move to an arrangement where they could perform work and DTC could decide whether or not they wanted to continue to do work with them. So the contract in and of itself is not a guaranteed contract that they will receive work. It's a conditional contract that if they do receive work, the terms will be as set forth in the party's contract, including that DTC will not be able to negotiate those prices if they're going to order the full scope of demolition as reflected in the pricing.
Okay.
Anticipatory repudiation can only occur upon a party's definite and unequivocal manifestation of its intent not to perform as required in the contract. Because the demolition contract did not require task order releases to be issued by DTC to Anderado, as a matter of law, no anticipatory repudiation could have occurred when DTC did not issue for these four buildings.
Well, let me come back to this question of which party or both are bound by the price. Now, it's your position that if DTC issues a TOR and doesn't change the scope of the work by saying, well, if somebody's already knocked half the building down, then both DTC and Anderado are bound by the listed price for that building?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and the record reflects that for the first task orders, first two task orders, that was the case.
But how do you reconcile that interpretation with what's under tab 4, the second page, ordering procedures, which talks about issuing a TOR and requesting a complete and detailed price proposal, post board. I mean, I would read that as giving DTC an opportunity to renegotiate the price.
Because, Your Honor, the TOR spells out the scope of work.
So you're saying that this would apply only if the scope of work differs from 100% demolition?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
Is there some place in here that actually says that? Or is that just what you're saying is a necessary inference reading the provisions
together? That's the necessary inference. And also, Your Honor, there would be that there's nothing in the record that there was no proposal on the first two task orders. But it does go back to sort of begging the question for why these task orders released in the first place, you know, that Anderado was paid on. If it would only encompass some type of change or change in the scope.
Right. I mean, why isn't a reasonable interpretation of these provisions, which I find a little less than self-explanatory, that your client has to use Anderado for all 44 buildings? However, it may be that other aspects of those 44 buildings change. Somebody else has already knocked half of them down. Maybe RTC changes the location of the line so some building doesn't have to be demolished at all, or only a small part of it has to be demolished. And that's the circumstance in which a TOR would issue, describing the changed scope of work and indicating that Anderado has to respond by deviating from the fixed price.
Because there's no contemplation of any other form of requesting work from Anderado other than the issuance of a TOR, which is qualified on an as-needed basis, which is in section...
Yeah, I don't think that's in the tab, but if it is...
See if I can find it in the tab for you.
Well, I don't think it is.
That's actually in the description of work at the record, page 61.
Well, it's in section 4, part 1, but I don't think that's one of the tab documents.
Oh, right, yeah. That's not included as a tab, but in the record at page 61, description of the work specific is what it says. Contractors' work required of each structure identified as requiring demolition on the Eagle P3 project as described in specific scopes of work and task orders issued on an as-needed basis.
Okay, but I guess my interpretation of as-needed would be more narrow than you just decided you'd rather have, your client just decided they'd rather have somebody else do the job.
Well, Your Honor, the contract provides for DTC to make the determination of whether or not Anderada was the appropriate party to perform the demolition in the first place, whether or not a parcel becomes available and Anderada is appropriate. The only work that was designated was to be designated by DTC. The contract that you're referring to, Your Honor, was the contract that they had in April that Anderada couldn't fulfill, a guaranteed contract. This is not a guaranteed contract because Anderada can't bind the contract.
Well, come back to my question. Why doesn't as needed basis implicate some objective standard as opposed to DTC's wholly subjective conclusion that for whatever reason, or perhaps even for no reason, it just wants to use another contract?
Well, because, Your Honor, see, I'm out of time, but there's no other language to the contrary other than to put that decision of whether or not to utilize Anderada into DTC's hands with the agreement that DTC will pay the prices as set forth in the party's contract. The scope of the work to be performed on the site was to be designated by DTC, and that the quid pro quo there is that DTC would have to pay those prices for that full demolition as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have four things I'd like to respond to. First was the question of any obligation. The blue language, the pink language, and tab 2 both say will. Precedent in Colorado is that will means must. That imposes an obligation. That comes out of Black's Law Dictionary. It was adopted by the Colorado Supreme Court in 2001 in RTD versus Outdoor Systems. So that language is you must order. If the building comes available, you must order and you must use our prices. That is an unconditional promise. That's directly contrary to what was found by Judge Martinez, as there was no unconditional promise. Turning to the argument of whether Anderada can do the work, there's an argument out there that DTC has unilateral right to determine whether Anderada can do the work. First off, we need to ask us first whether we can do the work and whether we can get the bonding. And that's done by a task order release. They have to ask first. They don't get the chance to unilaterally decide we can. The second is it more appropriate to have it done by an asbestos abatement contractor? So now we wander way outside the record and we ask you to take judicial notice of the environmental laws in Colorado and how they're administered. Simply stated, to get a demolition permit, first of all, a viable asbestos abatement has to be completed in the building and be inspected, and there has to be a certificate. And once that certificate is issued, then it's available for demolition. We can decide whether we want it done by the asbestos abatement contractor or not. Ignores what is a matter of public policy in Colorado, that all the viable asbestos has to be done, and then it becomes available for demolition by any contractor, including Anderada.
I believe your time is exhausted.
May I have one more minute?
Sure.
The fourth thing I want to talk about was the distinction between definite quantity, indefinite delivery task order contracts, and indefinite quantity, indefinite delivery task order contracts. It was in the opening brief. But the distinction simply is, in a definite quantity contract, you said we will order, shall order, or must order. In the indefinite quantity contract, the language to be used is we may order. This contract in tab 2 says will order. That is mandatory language. If you want to read more, it's in the trial record. I provided something last week, which is Feldman's write-up on indefinite versus definite quantity contracts. We also look in the appeal record, starting at page 246 to 247, to Ms. Brian Montell information. But Brian Montell is downstairs here in the library. The citation was to a specific section on requirements contract, back up one page downstairs, you can find McBride Montell's one paragraph on definite quantity, indefinite delivery contracts. That's all I have. Thank you for your time. We appreciate your patience, and we appreciate you letting us remember.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counselor excused. A written opinion will issue in due course.